Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. As most of you know all too well, my goal here is quite simply to make the lions roar, to make this great institution levitate. To help us achieve this goal, we have tonight Lena Herzog, who is joined by Lawrence Weskler. This evening is co-presented by ICP, the International Center of Photography. I want to warmly acknowledge Brian Wallace, Suzanne Nicholas, and Phyllis Levine, my co-conspirators. ICP is presently exhibiting Lena Herzog's haunting photographs, Lost Souls. After the conversation is over, I'm pleased to let you know that through ICP's generosity, we are all invited to view the exhibition in the company of the artist and to enjoy a reception. ICP, as you know, is a very short walk just across the street at 1133 Avenue of the Americas at 43rd Street. It's about a 2 minute and three quarters walk from here, something like that. With this event, we mark the closing of our Spring Live from the New York Public Library season. I'm happy to briefly announce a few of our upcoming events this fall, which will include conversations with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, Edwidge Danticat, Antonia Fraser, Zadie Smith, Derek Walcott, Nicole Krauss and David Grossman, and Angela Davis with Toni Morrison. Libraries, as Lena Herzog and all of you know well, matter greatly to our democracy. But did you know that Keith Richards, one of the founding members of the Rolling Stones, is writing his memoir due out in October? In it, he confesses his secret longing to be a librarian. When you are growing up, Keith Richards writes, there are two institutional places that affect you most powerfully: the church, which belongs to God, and the public library that belongs to you. The public library, he says, is a great equalizer. I have invited Keith Richards to be on stage come October to discuss, among other things, the role libraries play in our democracy. I believe he will have other things we can speak about with Keith Richards, but that will be one of them. I urge you to become a supporter of the New York Public Library, be it a young lion if you feel so young, or a conservator, or consider joining the President's Council. The New York Public Library is in the middle of a campaign, Don't Close the Books on Libraries. The New York Public Library is facing the harshest cut in its history, a proposed city budget, and it's no joke really, a reduction of $37 million that could shut down, and may shut down, 10 branches and slash service to just 4 days a week. You can immediately support the library and its mission with a simple, and we're very modern here, text message. Again, after the conversation is over, I urge you to take 1 minute to support the New York Public Library. As we make our way to ICP, you have about 2.5 minutes to get there, just stop. Text NYPL to the number 27722 to give $10 from your mobile phone. When prompted, reply yes rather than no, and that will complete your $10 donation. You have on your chairs this form, and I urge you to do it either today or tomorrow, or why not just every day. Our wonderful independent bookseller, 192 Books, has copies of Lost Souls available, which Lena Herzog has graciously agreed to sign after her conversation. Now, to introduce Lawrence Weskler and Lena Herzog, as well as provide us with a context for understanding Lost Souls, I have the honor of presenting to you Graham Burnett. Graham wrote the introduction to Lost Souls. He's an editor at Cabinet Magazine and an associate professor of history at Princeton University. Graham Burnett studies the relationship between power and knowledge and writes on human beings' changing understanding of the natural world. Burnett is the author of Masters of All Surveyed, which dealt with the story of cartography and imperialism in the 19th century, as well as the author of A Trial by Jury and Trying Leviathan. Ladies and gentlemen, please warmly welcome to this very stage Graham Burnett.
It's a great pleasure to be back in an institution that feels like home. I was the beneficiary of a Cullman Fellowship in the inaugural year of that wonderful institution that's become so important to the writerly and scholarly life here in the city. And so I'd just like to reiterate what Paul signaled at the outset, which is this is a very important time for the library, and the library has been so important to so many of us in supporting our work. My first book and my second book were both substantially brought to completion during my year here on that fellowship. It's, of course, also a great pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce to you this evening two friends, Lena Herzog and Lawrence Wren Weschler. So what I'm going to do in the next 5 or 10 minutes is introduce the main event. The folks will be coming to the stage in just a few moments. And then also, as Paul had suggested, work for just a few minutes to try to set up this work, which I think can be initially, it's difficult work, it's demanding work. As our theme this evening is the work and its context in some ways, I'll be trying to set up some of that context. So first, Lena Herzog. Herzog's books include Tauromachia, Flamenco, and Pilgrims. Her portfolios have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Paris Review, Harper's Magazine, and have been exhibited in Europe and in the United States. Her new monograph, Lost Souls, is published by DEMO in conjunction with, as you know, the current exhibition at the ICP. And she wanted me to draw attention to the fact that the portfolio of this work was first presented publicly in the Paris Review, which I think deserves a lot of credit for seeing the enormous potential of this work and stepping forward there. Wren Weschler, for more than 20 years a staff writer at The New Yorker, in many ways I think a truly significant pioneer in the genre of creative nonfiction as it's practiced now, the head of the New York Institute for the Humanities, who's done much to enliven that august institution, and a critic who has defied many of the conventions of art criticism in his series of generous, curious, spirited, and attentive volumes. Boggs, A Comedy of Values, Vermeer in Bosnia, his lovely book Convergences, done with McSweeney's. It's called All Things Rising, right? Everything That Rises. And his important studies and accessible studies, his important and accessible studies of a pair of towering figures in contemporary art, Robert Irwin and David Hockney. And perhaps most relevant to this evening, a book that may be known to a number of you, Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders, a book that's both about David Wilson's Museum of Jurassic Technology, but then also a historical foray into the Cabinet of Curiosities, the Cabinet of Wonders. Above all, Wren is an enthusiast, and that's what he brings to everything he does, and someone who knows how to listen and ask good questions, so you'll be getting a taste of that in a few minutes. So cabinets, that leads us to where we are in these powerful and in some cases I think disturbing and distressing images. The Cabinet of Curiosities, about which you'll be hearing more, was a significant site for thinking both about made objects and natural objects in the Renaissance and the early modern period. The tradition of the cabinet, princely cabinets, sites for the aggregation of diverse objects, synthesizing an encyclopedic view of the universe through its wonderful productions, forerunner of both the art museum and the natural history museum or the science museum. And it's it's significant to remember that in a funny way, from an intellectual history perspective, what we now think of as the two sides of the two cultures were kind of Siamese twins at their birth, and one could do worse than track their evolving distance than to trace how it is that the Cabinet of Curiosities diverged in its development into a forked path, one in the direction of what becomes the Metropolitan on the east side of the park, and the other in the direction of what becomes the Natural History Museum on the west side of the park. So we can imagine ourselves going back to the Stemma institution that combined both made wonders and natural wonders, and that presented them in their adjacencies as together significant occasions to think about God's power and to think about whatever the other powers were that were not God's powers. And that's, again, something I think that'll be significant to think about in the context of this work. Historians of science and intellectual historians more generally have spent a lot of time thinking about these institutions. And for those of you who want to dig in deeper on their significance in the history of ideas, I would draw to your attention a very important book called Wonders and the Order of Nature, authored by Lorraine Daston and Katie Park, which is a fascinating treatment of the idea of the wondrous between the late Middle Ages and the origins of the Enlightenment. So how wonders, exceptional things, strange things, anomalous things, like some of the things that are represented in these images we'll be looking at a little bit later, how those kinds of anomalous eruptions of the strange went from being treated as numinous, as portentous, to being treated as simply divergences from the norm. That way of getting control of the strange. Are these messages, or are these simply the margins? And you could, that's a reasonable way of talking about what happens between, say, 1250 and 1740 to some of the objects we'll be looking at in these images. Now, to go right to the heart of the matter for a moment, a considerable number of these images deal with death. And there is a powerful symmetry in going after death in the museum, which, you know, really in a way has been called a tomb with a view. Right? You have those taxidermied critters, you have the bones, you have the dead preserved in a museum setting. You're talking about an institution that's two steps from a mausoleum. Museum, but not entirely not a mausoleum. So powerful to think about death in the context of a museum, and of course also powerful to think about death in the context of photography, a medium which, at least it's been argued by Barthes and others, polemically, is a medium particularly powerfully suited to the treatment of death. Flat death, right, he calls it. But in each of those settings, the museum, and in photography, of course, we're in a realm really of a dialectic between death and preservation, between preservation and loss. Right? Nothing's more powerful for preserving than a photograph, but of course, as Bach so powerfully suggests, nothing more powerfully preserves loss than a photograph. And similarly, nothing more powerfully preserves than a museum. But in so doing, it's hard to imagine a setting where you're brought more powerfully into the presence of everything from the past in its lostness. So we have this double dialectic to consider. And this is a triple dialectic in Lina's work, because she's dealing with an art form of the early modern period, anatomical specimens and their preservation, which is yet again most fantastically positioned at this crossing of loss and preservation. This is now not an art form we much think on, right? But the idea that someone like Friedrich Rausch committed himself to the delicate preservation of von Hagen-like, that's the lineal descendant, anatomical specimens, preserved in a kind of vitality that is nevertheless a kind of ghostliness. Here we are once again in that distressing but powerful swampland between loss and preservation. It's there, I think, that I'll leave you with just a final thought. If the term apotropaic, big old rhetorical term, apotropaic devices for scaring away that which you're afraid of, right? So gargoyles, the classic example, the apotropaic device, the little evil eye medallion. You wear it to scare off what gives you fear. And one of the great paeans to the anatomical artists Lena has photographed and from whose work she has made her own work is indeed an ode to Reusch that argues that his art of death, this art of preserving the lost in the form of anatomical specimens, is designed to be an apotropaic device. That it's death, for sure. Nothing more dead than looking at lots of dead fetuses, say, in glass bottles. But that we are to understand his work as a technique for scaring death away. So I'll read you that line. This is from the title page to one of Reusch's works in the early 18th century. Through thy art, O Reusch, a dead infant lives and teaches, and though speechless, still speaks. Even death itself is afraid. And I can't show you, but I'll paint a picture for you in your heads of the image that stands over that ode at the beginning of the volume. It is literally an image of a set of little angels putting forth specimen bottles containing anatomical specimens, much like those that have been photographed in this volume. So the little putti are putting forward these jars. And what are they putting the jars forward for? They're putting them forward as a bulwark against this terrible skeletal figure of Father Time, who was coming with his scythe, but you can see on seeing these amazing lifelike dead objects in the jars, he staggers back like this. What are these things? Neither dead nor alive. And he recoils as if driven back. And what's really powerful for me about that image and about this work is that what we have here is an apotrope of symmetry. Usually we scare things away by showing something different. We scare away little demons with a glass pendant. We scare away the forces of darkness with a crucifix. The crucifix isn't an image of death. Oh, wait, maybe it is, actually. So it gets a little complicated. An apotrope of symmetry is to scare death away with death. And I think that that's something that you can hold and see if it helps you as we go ahead and take a look at some of the work to set up the conversation that follows. I'm going to go to the next one.
Thank you for coming. Lena, I think maybe the way to begin this conversation is just to talk about how you came to this subject. And to do that, just maybe begin by just saying, where do you come from? And how did you come upon these things?
Well, I was born in the Urals. What Ian Fraser would call it, the wrong side of the Urals, the eastern slope.
And the Siberian side.
That's right. And that's where I was born and grew up. And then when I was 16, I traveled back to where my family, at least my mother's side of the family, comes from, St. Petersburg, which was at the time Leningrad. And I studied at the St. Petersburg, at the time, Leningrad University, at the philological faculty. And the way I came to the subject was really by happenstance. We all knew about the cabinet, which was called Kunstkamera in St. Petersburg, but none of us really ever went there.
Where was it compared to where you were?
It's right next to the philological faculty of Leningrad University, on the embankment of the river, which is across from Hermitage and the Admiralty. It's probably one of the most beautiful spots in the world. It's a beguiling city. And it's in the palaces. The philological faculty is in the Blue Palace, and the Kunstkamera is in the Palace of Aquamarine. And our professors used to joke morbidly. I remember our professor of Latin used to say, students, if you do not conjugate correctly, I'm going to pickle you and send you next door. That's sort of how we knew about it. But we never really went. And one day I thought, well, as it is so ubiquitous in our slang, I'm going to go next door and look. And as with most of the cabinets, it's beautiful. It looks like the New York Public Library. Marble floors, crystal chandeliers, oak handmade shelves, and instead of books, they were these creatures. And the way that I came to the work was by that first encounter, because what I experienced then at the time was truly the experience of wonder. I felt that the ground left from under my feet and everything I believed, I wanted to believe, was immediately emptied from my head. And all the comforting thoughts were emptied, and I didn't have very many because I'm Russian. But also, it felt like it was some sort of a riddle. And it never left me. You see, you encounter a lot of nice work all the time. Daisies and lovely things. And they're lovely and they're instantly forgettable. This was not forgettable.
Was there an aspect of horror or of wonder or of awe?
Well, you see, when I saw it, the first day that I saw it, which was 23 years ago when I was 17, you do the math, I saw it not in the electric light, which gives it a warm look, but there was a blackout that day. And so you had this St. Petersburg silver light that made its way through the curtains and through these crystal chandeliers, and it sort of sprinkled this almost Christmas light along all the jars. And what you saw there were creatures. And by the way, on the way to these rooms of Reusch's creatures, of Reusch's preservations, you went through rooms filled with maps and astrolabes and old barometers and all kinds of gorgeously crafted instruments of travel. You were prepared to travel. I mean, you didn't realize where you were traveling is going to be upward or downward, completely other place. But you saw, for example, maps that said, had a fairly good representation of Europe, and then right next to it would be a dragon, and it would say, may dragons be there, somewhere where the New World, America, is. And as one Rand Wechsler said, one of the reasons that the cabinet became such a huge hit at the time of Renaissance is because the world was, Europe's mind was being blown by America.
The question that's often asked is, why do you have this sudden eruption of a taste for marvel, for wonder?
Yes.
Around 1500. It wasn't there before in that degree. And suddenly, for about 150 years, there's just this, Europe is just agog with a taste for marvel and wonder. And it's partly because of all this stuff that's coming in over the transom.
That's
from
right.
America.
That's right.
And not only the stuff itself, purple parrot feathers, you know, moose antlers, sacrificial urns, dinosaur bones. I mean, all this wild, weird stuff that's coming in. But the way in which that, in turn, allowed you to believe stuff that you'd gotten over believing.
That's right.
I mean, if narwhal tusks existed, sea unicorns, why couldn't unicorns exist? In fact, they must exist. In fact, human horns must exist. Of course it exists.
Of course.
And everything settled, and there's a sudden taste for it. It's also worth noting, of course, that part.
And I did not feel a sense of horror, because the way that I encountered them at first, actually, they didn't look fleshy. They looked like outer creatures from the outer world. They looked silver. They didn't have the flesh color. They were completely silver, and it looked like they were shining from inside because of the way they were.
You have some images of what cabinets look like.
Yes.
You might want to show some of those.
Let's look at the cabinets.
There's a PowerPoint, a few slides here.
And there are a few slides. So this is, for example, a Turin cabinet. It also presides.
Many of the images in your book are from other places besides Reusch's.
Absolutely.
Once you got going, but okay.
Yeah,
so
from over a couple of dozen cabinets. And this is one of them in Turin, Museo di Anatomia. In the middle stands actually the founder of this cabinet, who donated his own body, and there he stands overlooking his own cabinet. Now let's see next one. So this is the famous All Worm Museum. Next one, please. This one is from the Imperial Museum from Naples. Next one, please. This is some of the things that were there that fascinate me now as I discovered photography for myself. Lots of optical instruments and also tricks. Anamorphic art, some of the first cameras, cameras were also at the cabinets. Next one. This is, for example, one of the examples from the Santissima Trinità Cloister. Example of the anamorphic art, when you enter the cloister.
The kind of art that if you look at it from the side, you can finally see it. If you look at it head on, it looks completely smeared and odd. And then,
yeah. Actually, there's one of the pieces in New York, the Holbein's Ambassadors. You see the sort of a smear at their feet. And when you come To the right side,
and
you realize it's a skull.
And by the way, that particular piece was supposed to be at the top of a staircase.
Oh, right.
So that you would first arrive, you'd see the skull before you even saw the piece.
Ah.
And as you were coming up the steps, you'd see a skull. Obviously there, when you got there, it would be gone.
Right.
Because it was this spear.
Whatever. Yeah, and it was actually intended to be sort of...
a memento mori.
Memento mori. Right. But also intended to be a spectacle, a spectacolo. Yeah. And so here, at one point, this is a the Strait of Messina. If you look at it straight, and if you look at it from a side, this is St. Francis, the same exact image. Next one, please. And these are mine. I wanted to really somehow bring in the idea that this was about delineation of norm and delineation of the world. And the piece on the left, the piece from Henry Welcome, an acupuncture man from China, marked up and numbered his body and his thighs so as to mark that body and thighs are two. Also maps. And this is a slice of a profile of a man from the Mutter Museum, which to me looks like an aerial shot, but it's actually a slice of a face. And you see here, for instance, where is it?
His nose.
The nose, the eyebrow, and the eye, and the brain, the cheek. Next one. That's it. Okay. Yeah. All of them are, including Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, they're all actually very luxurious, beautiful-looking spaces. They don't really set you up for anything frightening.
Mm-hmm.
They set you up for wisdom, for insight,
mm-hmm.
something you would expect at the library.
Well, what they do is they give you pause.
For sure.
They still you. Which becomes important when we start talking about photography in a second. But one thing we've been talking about Ruysch, and maybe people here don't know much about Ruysch. Could you walk us a little bit about through who Ruysch was and what on earth were his jugged fetuses doing in St. Petersburg?
Yeah. Let's bring out our protagonists, please. He's definitely one of the heroes of this book and for me. That's the man. He lived to be almost 100. He died at the age of 92.
Frederick Ruysch.
Frederick Ruysch. And he was born in The Hague in 1638 to a family of very, very modest means. Despite all of it, he becomes a very prominent scholar. He becomes a botanist and anatomist and even called to be a forensic advisor to the Amsterdam court. Actually, the first one of the kind. And when asked why did he switch to anatomy, he said something very interesting. He said botany's questions were too simple. It was in anatomy where all the riddles lie. And
that reminds me, by the way, of something that Oliver Sacks once said when I asked him why he became a neurologist.
Yes.
And he said, well, you know, I mean, I could have been a cardiologist. I mean, the heart is a really interesting pump, but it's just a pump.
Yes, exactly.
Plants are fine, but they're just plants. But by the way, that's interesting you say that because his daughter becomes one of the great, great painters of floral scenes.
That's right, Raquel.
Raquel. When you go to those, when you go to museums and you see all those incredible wild floral paintings, she's one of the great masters of that. But coming back to him, he wasn't interested in flowers. He was interested in...
He wasn't interested in flowers. He was very much interested in bodies. And at the time, actually, when he started to do his preservations, the medicine consisted of a lot of guesswork. The elbow was approximately over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was because body instantly decays and becomes very different from live body. And the moment that he starts to preserve them, he actually can teach students. And
by the way, this is for all the weirdness of stuff we will be showing you of Ruysch's, any history of anatomy describes him as the grandfather of anatomy. He is the George Washington. He is the founding father of that discipline. And one of the things that's great about it is that all of you, if you go back to school, any of you young people here, 17th century intellectual history. Nothing better. It's just that time when people are on the one hand just doing really weird, yes, strange things, and at the same time are laying the groundwork for everything we do today.
That's right. Yeah. And especially in Holland, there's a fabulous book by your colleague, Professor Simon Sharma, called The Embarrassment of the Riches. And he calls it, there's this particular, very peculiar phenomenon that's very Dutch. And he calls it the precocity. And part of that precocity can be explained by the fact that the Dutch had the best navy in the world, mm-hmm, which was the great envy of the young prince, Peter the Great. But before we get to Peter and their friendship, one of the things that has to be understood about Hoesch is what an enlightened and extraordinary man he was. That when he realized the ills and the problems that were occurring during childbirth, he actually acquires not only the profession and the license of a midwife, which was held exclusively by women at the time. He makes these extraordinary advances there, including the instruments and methods. Not only that, but he strictly prohibits all the midwives to practice any kind of exorcism. Now, you may think, well, exorcism, those were the old days, you know, the leftover of the Middle Ages, and how could they not be? However, we're talking about 17th century, right? However, in the 21st century, one Sarah Palin underwent exorcism. Another American politician performed exorcism, Bobby Jindal. Suddenly, we're intelligible to the 17th century. And so it's not quite as archaic all of a sudden as it sounds. And Hoesch demands that all the midwives become professional, that they learn what he had invented, and it had become actually a profession of a kind. He also is a friend of Seba.
One thing before we get to that is that one of the effects of this, though, is being a midwife, he is present when these strange births happen.
That's right.
And so he's there, often stillbirth and so forth. It's worth putting ourselves back in the mind of that time. An awful lot more of this kind of thing happened because there wasn't, various intrauterine devices. There wasn't sonar. There wasn't all kinds of things that we've learned in the meantime. This was a not that unusual phenomenon that you would have very, very strange births that would go to term.
That's right.
Sometimes with fatal results both for the mother and the child.
For the most part. Yeah. In fact, the modern term for that is incompatible with life. But also the reason...
For both mother and
child. For both mother and child. That's right. But one of the reasons also that... Hoesch's practice became so extraordinary is he spared the women a lot, because if the women survived, that he made sure nobody knew, he created the whole procedure to spare them. He also had very, very serious ethic about exhibition.
Would preserve these strange
creatures
who had never really lived.
That's
one thing we want to talk about a second. About when one talks about death, it's not exactly what we're talking. We're talking about never having been born, in some profound sense. But so he would do that. But at the same time, he was a profoundly humanistic doctor.
In fact, he detested the kind of versions of sideshows. And he said, you better bury them than exhibit them like that.
It would be better to bury them.
It would be better to bury them than to be exhibited like so.
So what did he intend?
Well, he intended it for private viewing that was by appointment. By the way, many of the cabinets still function that way. And also he intended them for viewing for the students, and for educational, so to speak, purposes. And even the ones that he exhibited, he and Raquel, by the way, she was very much part of it, she would create these lace dresses and pearls, and they would drape over the most disturbing parts. Mm-hmm. The way that he exhibited them was highly judicious. Mm-hmm. He really cared a lot about that.
So you were mentioning Seba, and we have to get to Peter the Great. So
well, Seba, who was... Let's see, next
right, to
one.
The next one, before we get to Seba, look at this amazing picture.
That's a very famous anatomy lesson painting, which is in Leiden at the moment. Next
which
one
is... Wait, let's go back to that for a second.
Let's go back.
Which is Reusch?
Reusch is the one in the hat. He's...
holding the instrument he's holding.
He's holding the instrument right at the
dissection.
Child.
And who's over here with his little doll?
That's actually his son.
Yeah. Well, rather
his
amazing.
His children are very much part of it. Yeah. Actually, there's a very couple of very interesting stories. Next one is Seba, who's a friend of Reusch, and he was the one who first met Peter the Great, our other protagonist. Next one, please.
And what's Peter doing there? And how old is Peter at this point?
Well, Peter was quite a bit younger than Reusch, and he was...
I think he was 16 years old or 17 or something like that.
That's right, that's right. He was a
And he was a big guy.
He was a very tall man, yes, at the time. He was 6 feet, which is at the time was really a giant. But he was head above everybody in every sense of the word. First of all, he was brought up with mostly Western tutors, including Dutch. He was fluent in Dutch. At some point, he actually wanted Dutch to be the formal language in Russia. Don't know how Brothers Karamazov would have sounded then, but anyhow... But he went to Holland, and he became a laborer at a wharf because what he really, truly wanted was the Navy. He knew Russia was backward, Russia was inward, and he started looking out towards the rest of the world. He needed Navy for it. And while he was in Holland, a very young man, working as a laborer and acquiring 20 other crafts, by the way, he met Seba, and through Seba he met Reusch. And in Russia, medicine was essentially non-existent. Reusch teaches Peter the Great dentistry. Russian Tsar Peter the Great becomes the first dentist in Russia. No joke. Surgery. And when Peter the Great sees the first... one of the first preservations of Reusch done in his presence, it was a boy child. Peter's eyes filled with tears, according to the diary of Reusch. He went on his knees and he kissed the boy's head. And he begged Reusch to sell him his collection for Russia. He buys it for astronomical at the time amount of money, 30,000 guild, and sends it back with one of the first Russian sailors from Taganrog. According to the legend, the sailors drank the fluid from the jars. Actually, not true. Sounds plausible for Russian sailors. A lie. Did not happen. Did not happen. Collection arrived absolutely intact. And first it was placed in the summer palace of Peter the Great. Then it was transferred to another place, Kikin House, and then into the first building, Kunstkamera, which became not only the first cabinet, the first museum in Russia, it also became the first public library in Russia.
Wasn't there a story about Peter? It was because there was a twinned Siamese tree or something at that spot, or what?
That's right. When Peter was looking for a place where to build the house for Reusch's collection. He was, according to the legend, going back and forth on the embankment, and he saw two pine trees growing into each other like passionate lovers, one intertwined with another. You couldn't see where one began and the other one ended. And he said, how wondrous nature is. And according to the legend, he said that's where the Kunstkamera was going to be, and that's where the first Kunstkamera, the first cabinet museum and public library
was built. The place that you walked into.
The place where I walked into, next to the philological faculty of Leningrad University.
I want to move things over a little bit and talk about this feeling we have when we, what exactly are we looking at when we look at these remarkable objects? And I'm not sure. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about death, but I raised this issue a second ago. It's not exactly death.
No.
It's never to have been born. I mean, there's that the great stoical line, you know, worst is, the best would be never to have been born. And this is it itself. I mean, this is, and parenthetically, is problematic religiously speaking, because what exactly is the status of these things we're looking at? Do they have souls and so forth? Talk a little bit about the objections that people had in Peter's time, even, to showing to this.
Well, first of all, the objections that they had to them in Peter's time. Actually, they had huge objections to Peter himself, mm-hmm. because Peter was bringing essentially enlightenment to Russia before there was enlightenment. And he was loathed, utterly loathed by the Russian Orthodox Church and called the Antichrist. And he was suspected to be not only the Antichrist, but a foreigner, a German. And they were actually monks that would leave monasteries because, and at the time in Russia, even now, that's suicidal, to go into Russia, it gets very cold, and to prophesize that Peter the Great was an antichrist. And for some of them, according to a couple of books that I've encountered, Reusch's collection was proof positive, evidence of that. So
because?
Clearly.
Why?
Well, because they looked so demoniacal.
And so demonic.
Demonic, yes. Mm-hmm. And so as Peter the Great was suspected to be Antichrist to begin with, well, that was proof. Of course,
And what status, I mean, your title is Lost Souls. Were they thought to have souls? Were they thought to what's all that
They didn't
about?
Quite know what to do with their souls. And according to one of the outspoken monks, they couldn't. These souls could not go anywhere. They could not go to heaven. Well, how could they? They could not go to hell because they've done nothing. But also limbo was assigned to the stillborn babies that were normal. And if they were to encounter these creatures, they would be too scared. So they couldn't go there anyway. So they just prescribed, well, they go nowhere. They were also not buried. So and unburied bodies were suspected, as they are in many cultures, to be maybe even vampirical. We're talking 17th century. But yeah. Also, it's not only that. Simon Schammer, for example, quotes the exact same term, lost souls, in the, for example, family of group paintings by Myers and Mytens that show a living family, and then above the children that did not make it, although they were normal. But still, the term for them was lost souls. It occurs on many occasions when you read about that.
And when one says that, does that mean that they are souls that have lost their way, or that we lost them, or what does the lost mean there exactly?
That they have no domain, that they have no citizenship anywhere, the souls.
And yet, clearly, obviously, they have incredible purchase on us.
They do.
I mean, they have... I mean, this is one of the things I want to get to about these images. You've seen some of them. I want to say this about Reusch, but I especially want to say this about you. I do not consider these images morbid in the least. The thing that's incredible, well, you can't say that about yourself. I'm praising you right now.
I'm talking about Reusch, yes.
But what I want to say is the thing that is overwhelming about is a kind of tenderness.
Yeah.
Without sentimentality. It's a kind of lucid tenderness. And in fact, a soulfulness that just radiates. And I've been trying to think about that a little bit. There was something, I warned you I might read you some poems, so I'm going to read you a poem. Two Polish poems come to mind. One of them is the classic poem by Zbigniew Herbert about the pebble. Now, keep in mind, these are things that were never alive that we're looking at.
Yeah.
They might as well have been pebbles in some sense.
Right.
Pebble. The pebble is a perfect creature, equal to itself, mindful of its limits, filled exactly with a pebbly meaning, with a scent that does not remind one of anything, does not frighten anything away, does not arouse desire. Its ardor and coldness are just and full of dignity. I feel a heavy remorse when I hold it in my hand and its noble body is permeated by my false warmth. Pebbles cannot be tamed. To the end, they will look at us with a calm and a very clear eye.
Beautiful.
Now, Wisława Szymborska, his contemporary, the great Nobel Prize winning poet, has a poem called Nothing's a Gift. Nothing's a gift. It's all on loan. I'm drowning in debts up to my ears. I'll have to pay for myself with myself, give up my life for my life. Here's how it's arranged. The heart can be repossessed, the liver too, and each single finger and toe. Too late to tear up the terms, my debts will be repaid, and I'll be fleeced, or more precisely, maybe flayed. I move about the planet in a crush of other debtors. Some are saddled with the burden of pain off their wings. Others must willy-nilly account for every leaf. Every tissue in us lies on the debit side. Not a tentacle or a tendril is for keeps. The inventory, infinitely detailed, implies we'll be left not just empty-handed, but handless, too. I can't remember where, when, and why I let someone open up an account like this in my name. We call the protest against this state of affairs the soul. And it's the only item not included on the list. Wisława, take it away. But the thing I want to raise here is this incredible, these are creatures, they're not dead, they were never alive. And yet they are so...
Some of them were for a moment.
For a moment.
A moment.
But they are so eternally on the cusp of living, on the cusp of liveliness. I want to push away the notion that this is about death. This is about imminence. This is about being on the cusp of living forever.
That's right. I mean, both you and Graham are right. And I think it made particularly poignant...
But we said
poignant,
the opposite things.
But that's because
right, exactly.
These things that seem to be oxymorons,
right.
They actually are very much alive in the work of Reusch and his followers, because somehow mortality and immortality, things that you can't imagine being simultaneous, actually happened, because they are immortal forever. All their siblings have long been dead. Their siblings, children, grandchildren, grandchildren, they've all been dead, and yet they have made it. And in fact, as a photographer, I feel an extraordinary kinship with the archivists and the cabinet makers, because what they do is they do what Munch called, painter Munch, the freeze of life.
F-R-I...
The freeze of life.
Okay, right.
Uh-huh. Of life. So they preserve a moment that's meant to perish, and they send it to us like a message in a bottle. And it's somehow...
Literally a message in a bottle.
Really, literally a message in the bottle. And to us. And we go back and meet it halfway if we have our eyes open and strong enough hearts. And we can look at it and think about...
So let's
all
by the way,
I,
one thing I wanted to talk to you about for a second was precisely the Reusch in his dark room and you in your dark room.
Yeah.
I mean, Reusch is taking these stillborn creatures and through a, I thought it was formaldehyde. It's not formaldehyde.
It's
a
some
concoction. He is pouring.
Formaldehyde is much, much lighter.
Right. Yeah. So he has created.
It was a solution that he kept secret, and I think he was actually coy about it because Peter the Great's condition of the sale was that he would know the secret because, of course, Peter wanted to learn everything and to teach Russia everything, and so part of the condition was the solution. Doesn't really quite work. The Russians later, the Russian anatomists who follow in these steps, kind of figure out on their own. And the Reusch muddies the waters. He works like the scientists at the time. He has his own secrets.
Right.
So, you know, it's a little bit of pig's blood, some vinegar, you know, some alcohol. It reads like a cooking recipe, actually.
Well, we're going to get it. So he basically is creating this concoction and
yes,
pouring this elixir.
Yes.
Of eternal life onto this, and then and working in these secret ways in this dark room, perhaps by himself.
But also, what his enormous achievement was to preserve the minutest blood vessels, which was impossible to do before he created it. And he devised a way to preserve all tissue intact. So all the bodies really looked very much alive till now, you know, more than 300 years later.
So we've got him doing that, and then you talked about the face meeting the face. We have you taking the picture,
yes,
which in itself is, I suppose, interesting, but we'll talk about that some other time. What I want to talk about right now is you in your darkroom, because you develop your own pictures, right?
I develop my own negatives, and I print my own prints. So
is that that's an important part of your process? I mean,
it's key.
How so?
Because I arrived to understanding photography, understanding light through the darkroom. I did not study in art school. I studied linguistics and then philosophy. And but I studied photography. In a sort of medieval way, I apprenticed to two truly great printers, Ivan Dalatana from Milan, an Italian printer, and Marc Valicello, a French printer, who lives now in Los Angeles. And I learned all the techniques that, from the very beginning, the salt prints, the albumen prints, the bromide prints. And I tested all kinds of techniques in the darkroom for developing negatives. And I arrived to the actually one of the first techniques as the superior one called Pyro. And Pyro, which is spelled P-Y-R-O, was first discovered in 1802 by Thomas Wedgwood, who's a relation to the Wedgwood family who makes china.
Porcelain.
Porcelain.
I mean, that kind of china. Right?
That kind of china, yeah. And they found that, for example, if you leave keys on leather and then they're exposed to the sun, you see the outline of the keys.
Don't you just hate it when that happens?
and so somehow Thomas Wedgwood, who was a very good chemist, he figured out how to secure that with pyrogallo crystals. Then 40 years later, Talbot, Henry Fox Talbot, in 1842 patents the technology in 1842, and in 1880s it becomes actually a product. Later, less toxic and far easier techniques make it into the market. They are inferior by far. And what Pyro has done is really taught me a lot how to understand light, how light works, and also how to build sculpture. Because when, for example, you take a picture with your digital camera, you take a file. What you do with a negative, you build a sculpture. And with Pyro, it is especially so because it builds a stain. The negative comes out slightly heavier than it goes in. And I'll show you at the ICP later, if you care to come, actually some of these negatives. They looked like gravures, like plates. And at the edges of the outlines, you see the clamping of grain in a way that makes them extraordinary. It's called a hard edge anomaly, hard edge anomaly. They can be like a cutout, or they can be very gray, whatever you like. It's an enormous range. And that requires a lot of work in the darkroom because pyro is very complicated. It's very, well, it's toxic and it's also very not very predictable. You have to be extraordinarily careful. And developing
again, all
and
this,
printing...
All of this sounds like Ruysch. And 300 years ago, I mean, with his chemicals and his and trying to get the thing, the expressions just right and to get
the expression has to be just right, and you have to have a range, and you have to have technology that is superior. It's not a sentimental attachment mm-hmm. to the past; it's just better. It's just simply better.
But what must it be like to be there in the dark room as the image is coming up, welling up out of the past, out of or where is it welling up from out of exactly? I mean.
It's like, you know, E.G. Robertson, Phantasmagorie,
mm-hmm.
In 1787, E.G. Robertson created this, in the ruined Capuchin, created Phantasmagorie,
Phantasmagoria,
the theater of ghosts, and all of a sudden, through the magic lantern, he would project ghosts, some of them, where angel, there was one who was a bloody nun, I remember, I read about it. And he had the rails that were set at an angle to the screen. So, and he would roll the magic lantern at an angle to the screen, meaning that the ghosts would change shape and they would sort of wobble and waft and they would really look very real. The dames fainted. And everybody had a good time. And so it really looked like that magic lantern, in a way, experience. Mm-hmm. And, of course, my darkroom, because it's volatile chemistry that I use, it has to be really, really dark. In fact, I become completely nocturnal, so nocturnal that when I drive out, I have to put a big yellow sticker on my driving wheel, turn the lights on, because when I drive out at night... I don't really need the lights, but other cars do. So they start honking because I drive like a ghost in my car at night with lights off. So anyway,
But that moment, I want to come back to that moment of this, of these never born, always alive creatures from 300 years ago come welling up.
They looked alive. They didn't look dead at all. Can we see moral tableaus? Because, and also Ruysch, and of course he affected everybody who came after him, they set them up in expression. Of course, it's not an accident that his hands are folded in a pietà. Next one, please. They looked tender. They didn't look dead. They looked like they were having a whisper. Next one. Next one. Or tender disagreement. Next one.
Can we actually, before we go there, let's go back a couple. I want to bring up something. The one before that, maybe. Yeah, let's look at that for a second. That is... so alive and so, I mean, one wants to say psychologically intense and so forth, or lively, not just with, not in the abstract, but in the
yes.
facticity, the thingness of the and I was trying to figure out for myself why that was, and there's this incredible essay of Sartre's, which you'll never find, called Faces. It's in a book of an essays in phenomenology. I don't know why this isn't not only... Somebody should just take it and carve it in stone and put it, you know, on a building. It's so beautiful. It's just a short 4-page essay about faces, where he's trying to figure out what is it about what are faces? What phenomenologically, what is our faces at their essence? And he says, you know, obviously they're flesh, but they're not flesh the way a thigh is a thigh. Mm-hmm. They are filled with greedy holes, he says at one point, ravenous in all the holes. And then he talks about the way he says that there's universal time. Which is made up of instant set end to end. It is the time of the metronome, of the hourglass, of fixed immobility. Now we know this is the time of a marble statue, for example. It exists. Against this stagnant background, the time of living bodies stands out because it is oriented, moving toward something. And then he goes on to say, and so it is with faces. I'm alone in a closed room, submerged in the present. We'll say a dark room. The future is invisible. You're by yourself. There is no future. You're completely present in the present. I imagine it vaguely beyond the future. I imagine it vaguely beyond the armchairs, the table, the walls, all these sinister and indifferent objects which hide it from me. Then someone enters, bringing me his face, and everything changes. In the midst of these stalactites hanging in the present, the face, alert and inquisitive, is always ahead of the look that I direct upon it. It hastens towards its countless appointments and so forth. And we shall, he goes, amidst a futurity, a futurity, however you pronounce it, future, surrounds the face, its future. Just a little trail of mist, only enough to fill the hollows of my hands, but I cannot see the face of men through their future. And this visible future is in itself a kind of magic. And we shall say that a visible future is the meaning of the of a face. They are, I mean, frozen, never having even been born.
And yet they have so much human expression.
And not only human expression, but orientation, and especially welling out from the the puddle of chemicals that you've got to meet you.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Giacomo Leopardi, when he saw in 1949, Leopardi, one of the great Italian poets, when he saw Reusch's collection, he wrote extremely beautiful poem, a fairly short one, called The Chorus of the Dead. And all returns to thee, alone, eternal, and all thee returning. O death, in thy vast shadow, simple and bare with anguish, not happy, but from the anguish of life at last set free. The night falls on the shaken spirit, and dark confuses. The withered soul and hope refuses, spent and uncaring. Free now from sorrow and from fear forever, we lie here undespairing through void eternity. We lived, and as a fountain from a dream of terror wanders into the day and draws across the speechless souls of children a memory and a fear, we, as we linger here, are haunted still by life. But fears of children haunt us not now. What were we? What was that bitter point in time that bore the name of life? Mysterious, stupendous, lost in our thought that hidden country lies. As in our day they lay the secret land of death, and as from dying our living souls drew back, so now they draw back from the flame of life. Simple and bare to languish, not happy, but not in anguish, for happiness we know, fate upon life or death will not bestow.
I'm struck by the rhyme of that with the Nabokov line you put at the beginning from Speak Memory, which is...
It's one of my favorite sentences in all of literature. The cradle rocks above the abyss, and common sense tells us that our life is but a brief crack of light between two eternities...
Crack of light.
Of light. Between two eternities of darkness. Although the two are identical twins, man, as a rule, views the prenatal abyss with more calm than the one he's heading for. Exactly. Exactly.
But again, what is so moving to me about these images, and they aren't morbid for a minute to me, but they are, they feel what is so profoundly, philosophically confusing and confounding and vertiginous is that we meet the gaze that was never there.
That's right. And that's a riddle. It remains to me a riddle, and it's beautiful to be that mystery.
The gaze of these creatures is no more there than the gaze of a photograph is there, which is another mystery.
That's right.
How is it that when you look at a photograph, you get all queasy, a photograph of a loved one or whatever? It's just a bunch of paper with weird chemicals on it. It's not there. It's not alive. And yet it peers out at us. It's completely remarkable.
That's right. And it stays. It has a staying power that it kind of keeps scratching at the back of our spine. It doesn't leave us. And that's...
It's striking, by the way, that in this context, people might not know some of your other work. I mean, there's a whole body of your work, for example, with bullfighters and toreador. A whole different aspect of gazing upon people, gazing upon death, or looking death
right.
in the
well,
face.
Well, the thing about death is you can't photograph death because you can't photograph nothing. Death is nothing. You can't photograph nothing. There has to be something to photograph. But one thing that I always was actually afraid to do is to do sort of nice work. I don't want to do nice work. I want to do... and I also have this...
you Russians.
I know. but I also want to somehow preserve the moments that capture me and mm-hmm. cross my fingers that someone else might feel the same. Mm-hmm. And the thing about bullfights was the same way that I had the reaction to Reusch's work, and that was it wasn't something that I liked, it wasn't something that I loved, it wasn't something that was pretty, but it had sublime beauty about it. With all the awful other things that come to mind. And because it's complicated territory, it does not leave you easily. And that's important. And of course, there was also something, by the way, I mean, there are many things to mention, but there was something peculiarly Gogolian, especially about...
Gogol.
From Gogol, a great Russian writer who founded the venerable institution called the Russian Novel. And that was the first one that's considered by Russians and by the critics dead souls. And that is the combination of tragedy and comedy. Sounds odd, but in a lot of the cabinets, there's actually quite a serious comedic element. And especially I felt so when I heard, and first I heard about this, was the Mice Orchestra of E.J. van der Miele, which is sequestered in a catacomb, it's not on display, of Leiden Medical University Center. When I asked why is it that they hid it, they said, here I quote, "The museum commission decided that it wouldn't be fitting the storyline of the new permanent exhibition at the Leiden University Medical Center." That's unfortunate. And that's actually a problem of a lot of cabinets because they don't fit to our idea of exhibiting body or skeletons, even if it's mice. Mm-hmm. And the story with E.J. van der Miele is really quite extraordinary. It also fits exactly the profile of all the cabinet makers. They are polymaths, highly sophisticated, a little cranky. And E.J. van der Miele was particularly so. He was known at the time to be sort of a 19th century hate blogger. He would...
What?
Like a blog. He would write hate poetry.
Hate blogger.
Like a hate blogger, yes.
I thought that's what you said, but I just wanted to make
He would write hate poetry mm-hmm. to all his presumed enemies, and he would write it out and then nail it to the door of the enemy, like Martin Luther. For example, when he hated a particular building, he said, "This building has been made of rotten cheese and false weight." Sometimes he would write in pentameter things he really couldn't stand. And at the same time, he delivered over 5,000 babies. And also a very great doctor. And he had mice in his barn. And
what year are we in right now?
We are in 1860.
You will understand, by the way, that she's looked at her watch, and we're now beginning to wrap this up. So we're going to look at something really cool and send us out with some joy in our hearts. But go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to send you off with joy in your heart. And 2 years it took me to persuade the curators of the Leiden Medical Center to allow me to photograph it. It's in a pressurized capsule. It's a display only this big. And it's an orchestra. And it's an orchestra made of the mice that Dr. Wiele had in his barn.
So before you show it to us, I just want to invite all of you to join us. I believe it's 2 minutes and 35 seconds, or what was it?
Yes.
We're just going to all walk out together. Are you going to sign your books here, or are you going to sign your books there?
Somebody
tell us
both.
What's going on? Anybody know? Anyway, well, just follow us. We'll eventually get there. And we're going to the ICP, where there is a reception, where you'll see these pictures and many others. It's, by the way, a gorgeous thing. You are not permitted to live without having seen this. You will have ruined your life if you don't go over there right now, because it's just really cool. But before we go, and as our sending you out with joy in your hearts, we give you the Mice Orchestra. Thank you.